Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. On this week's literary review, I'm joined by author Kathy Rensenbrink to discuss three titles that have kept her turning the page over the past week. Kathy, welcome to the show. The title of our first book reinforces a thought that many of us have probably had from time to time. It's called I Hate the Internet and is written by Turkish-American author Jarrett Kobek. This novel explores the state of San Francisco in the 21st century through the story of Adeline, a comic book artist whose flippant comments end up causing outrage online. Kathy, what stood out to you about this?
Well, I was drawn to it because of the title, I Hate the Internet, because I have been thinking lately about how much I hate the internet. Not that I want to be a Luddite, because obviously the internet is also full of amazing things, but I've been realising that I did used to think of it as a democratising force, a force for good, and lately I've been thinking that maybe that isn't the case and that maybe we're not designed to cope with so many opinions. And actually, I think possibly the internet is bad for our mental health in ways that we don't even begin to understand yet. So that's sort of what sucked me in. And I must say, all those bits are very well done. And he absolutely expresses why I hate the internet in a better way than I have just done. More amusing, more bitter, more angry. But essentially the idea, and now I'm slightly morphing what I think into what is written in this book, but sort of the idea that we're just all traffic, aren't we? That's the thing. We have this idea that we're creating interesting thoughts and sharing them with the world, but we're just traffic for news channels and social media companies. He goes very hard into those companies, and quite an amusing bit of it is that because of the libel law in the UK, this publication has lots of stuff that's been redacted.
Okay, so mentions of Google and Facebook.
Yes,
they've all
been blacked out. And what he does is, you don't tire of this. I still found this joke funny all the way through. Every time something's blacked out, he just puts Jim will fix it in brackets at the end, because his point that he makes in the foreword is, you know, the UK is a country where Jimmy Savile managed to do horrible, horrible things for years openly, and yet the laws of the country mean that you're not allowed to write true things about rich people in books. And I think that point is really well made, you know, and it's funny. I think sometimes probably the limitations of satire, and this may just be my problem, is that once you've understood what's going on, once you kind of get the satire, you sort of get it, don't you? And I think often I think
there
it's difficult.
How many levels afterwards?
Well, it's more that it's difficult then to think of it as a story that has a resolution, in a sense, I think. So I don't know whether that's a criticism of this book or a criticism of satire or a critique of my relationship with satire. I'm not sure, but I would highly recommend it, and it's very funny in places. And I was sort of very much nodding along and and just thinking it's very good. And there's an awful lot of good stuff about being a woman in a world that hates women, particularly online, because Adeline, the main character, is sort of reaching the end of what the world views to be her bracket of being sexually desirable and how all that works.
Interesting, because I was going to say, I mean, you know, because it's a satire, it's very easy to talk about the kind of the way this connects to the real world and the problems with the internet. But this is a novel. So what actually happens to Adeline? I mean, what does she do? And then what's this reaction against her?
Well, she commits the great sin, as he says, the only unforgivable sin of the 21st century, which he doesn't then tell you what that is for several pages, which is quite funny. But I think it is being recorded when you don't know that you're being recorded.
I see. Okay.
Which is interesting, isn't it? Because I sometimes find, I do lots of book events. I'm quite often recorded and nobody's told me. And
right.
It doesn't particularly matter to me. But it's still very disorientating to find out that you think you were speaking to a room of 30 people and actually, and then people just tag you into a tweet. You're now on SoundCloud.
Yes.
Am I?
Oh, I'm now available to anyone to listen to in the entire
yes.
world.
Oh, I wish I thought a little bit more about that point that I, you know, started to make and then ran out halfway through. So she doesn't realise she's being recorded. She riffs off on various subjects, says various things, and then lots of people take offence to bits of it, none of which seem particularly offensive. But I think that's one of the problems with the internet. There is always somebody who's going to be offended by some of what you say, even if it seems very impossible to take offence at. And then, of course, the problem, I think, the problem creatively is that if you allow yourself to only create what you think isn't going to make people cross, then it wouldn't be very good.
It's incredibly boring, absolutely.
Yeah. There's a good bit in it about writers and how writers should be taking on the internet, but instead they're actually just using it to market their books.
And I see.
I think that's. I thought that was very interesting as well. Having personally decided that I'm never going to do a tweet that says, I'm the Kindle Daily Deal today.
Right, okay. I mean, because it has been described as a bit of a morality tale about the internet. But I guess you described it as quite a bitter book in one sense. But is there a sense of solution at the end? I mean, is there a thought that actually this is how it should work, or this is how we want it to work?
I'm not sure there is. And I think that's back to, does satire ever give solutions? Is that what satire is for? And actually, I think one of the problems with the internet, again, is it almost leads you into thinking you should have solutions. But we don't have solutions, so instead we just get very angry with people with slightly whom we should disagree. And it all distracts us from what's actually happening, and we boil ourselves up into impotent rage and fury. And then, therefore, all the people that want to make money out of that carry on making the money out of it. So for those reasons alone, I think it's very much worth reading. And there's loads of really good jokes about writers and writing and creativity.
I Hate the Internet has just been published in the UK by Serpent's Tale. Next up, we have The House of Birds, the fourth book by British writer Morgan McCarthy. Here we meet Oliver as he embarks on a journey to self-discovery after finding a diary from the 1920s. Cathy, tell us a little bit about this diary that he finds.
So this is a diary who's written by a woman called Sophia, and he finds it in an old house. So his girlfriend has been left a house. He has walked out of his job, so he volunteers to go and look after the builders coming into the house. She wants to do it up and sell it. And then he finds this old diary and becomes very into Sophia's story. And Sophia's story really is happening in the 20s, but also casts back to the long shadows thrown by the First World War. She's a very interesting character. She longs to learn things. This is in time when she's not allowed to go to the library. And she is living with her husband, George, who has shell shock, though I don't think that's ever mentioned or used as a term in the book. There's also a spectacular bit where she finds out several years before she had a miscarriage. And she finds out that actually she won't be able to have children. And they've known that, the doctors, since the time of the miscarriage, but they just sort of didn't bother telling her because, you know, it probably wouldn't have been good for her to know at that time. And nobody ever remembered to tell her ever again. So for the several years that have elapsed between those two times, she's just been wanting to have a baby and not thinking she can. So it's really good on what it was like being a woman in those times. And she has a sister. So she herself is scholarly, but she has a sister who's more our idea of what the Roaring Twenties might look like, all sort of silk scarves and scent and smoking cigarettes in a very glamorous way.
And I mean, Oliver, I guess that we have these two narratives going along sort of simultaneously. Why is Oliver so drawn to this diary? I mean, who is Oliver, and what kind of aspect of him do you think it reveals that he's so interested in this life of a 1920s woman?
I think he's interested in possibly a simpler time. What the books that I've chosen for this week would seem extremely different books, but actually what they have in common, which I didn't realise when I was choosing them, was that they're really all about consumption, I think. And one of the things Oliver is very preoccupied about is that he's been sort of doing a life that he doesn't want to lead, and he's been doing a job that he hates, all because he thinks he needs to have stuff. And his girlfriend Kate wants to have stuff, and she has this sort of dream lifestyle in New York. And there's a very interesting thread about how much he hates the way she uses social media to post pictures of champagne at drinks parties to show how well she's achieving at things. And he just, he hates that. There's this bit, can I read a little bit?
Of course, yeah.
This is him talking to Kate, and she's telling him all about, you know, she's telling him various stuff about her, their friends. They're supposed to be their friends, but really he thinks of them as her friends. As he listened, he felt a kind of fatigue settling in at the hard machinery of life, money and mortgages, marriage and adultery and divorce, difficult pregnancies and difficult deliveries, work, work, more work. He thought that Sophia was right. At any point in history, the human truth would be the same. Pick an era, pick a person, and you'd find someone worrying about all those things, trying, in the din of it, to remember love, the supposed point of it all.
Beautiful. And do you get the feeling that he is kind of falling in love with Sophia at this stage? I mean, is that the point of the book? Do you think that he gets lost in this era that's completely gone, and this woman that is now presumably dead?
I think he is rather enthralled to her as a character, and I think it's a really obviously lots of novels work on a structure of a rediscovered diary, a rediscovered cache of letters. I love books like that. I'm very drawn to them. It's unusual, much more unusual, to have a male character in the present finding something written by a woman in the past. Much more usual to have a female character finding something. So I quite liked that I think that's a little bit of interesting gender flipping. And again, that theme runs through it. There's also very interesting comparing the two relationships. So we've got Sophia and George in the 1920s. George, who used to be a different person, but for the various things that have happened to him, is now not able to love Sophia in any way. And then Oliver and Kate. What's really unusual about the way these are drawn is they're both, I think it's safe to say, fairly unhappy relationships, but we get shown that they weren't always. And that's very interesting, because you don't really get that in novels either. People are either the whole point of the story is they get together and then we, you know, and then they live happily ever after, or you sort of meet them when they're unhappy. You don't often get the trajectory, and I'm very interested in that, because I think that's where the meat is, really.
Yeah, the arc.
Yes.
The House of Birds by Morgan McCarthy is out now, published by Tinder Press. From fiction to actual history now, as we discuss The Riviera Set, a new book that depicts a group of people who frequented the Château de l'Horizon near Cannes over the course of 40 years. People like Rita Hayworth, Winston Churchill and Greta Garbo were all guests in the white Art Deco house, and this book sets out to tell the often sensational stories that hail from the building. Cathy, tell us about the Château, first of all. Who actually owned it?
Well, so the person that owned it was called Maxine Elliott, who was a very famous actress and a very famous person. But I must admit, I hadn't ever heard of her, despite the fact that I like, I call this genre of books posh people behaving badly. And it's a genre I'm quite keen on. It is sort of my guilty pleasure, a curl up on the sofa with some sort of, you know, 1915 diaries that include lines. This is the Duff Cooper diaries. Includes lines like, I had a pint of champagne for breakfast on my way to, you know, the War Office and having adulterous relationships with several people. I've mixed up lots of eras right. in his diaries, but his diaries are worth a read precisely because of the philandering and the excess. So I like these sorts of books, but I don't really remember reading about her. But she was born as Jessie Dermott in America, with an Irish father who was sort of an orphan of the famine and had managed to get himself to America. And he's a fascinating character. So the first couple of chapters are her background. She managed to become an actress, and Maxine was her stage name. And she's apparently the first person to be called Maxine. She invented it because she thought Maximilian sounded like a very grand name. And then she thought Maxime for a while would be good, and then just changed it to Maxine. Which wow. I thought was very interesting. Yeah, because now loads of people are called Maxine, aren't they? So that was her. She invented it. Had a very interesting life as an actress. Came to the UK and sort of managed to get into high society. Edward VII was a friend, and possibly more, though nobody knows exactly what happened behind the closed doors. And he went to one of her plays and stood to applaud, and that meant she was accepted into that strata of society. So all that stuff is extremely interesting. She then got a country house in England called Hartsbourne and was known as the Queen of Hearts. Nice. and then she used to invite people for weekend parties. And in those times, weekends were called Saturday to Mondays.
Okay.
So that was all going on. And then there's also sadness as well. The man she was in love with was killed during the First World War. She did a lot of war service, like lots of society women, ambulance driving, and she set up a big project to help people. And then eventually, a bit heartbroken and fed up with England, she decided to build this house at a time when people used to winter there. But the idea was it was too hot to be in the summer.
Oh, really? So the French Riviera was a winter destination?
It was, yeah. Funny. And then they sort of rebranded it. And it was obviously close to where Sarah and Gerald Murphy were entertaining the Fitzgeralds and the Hemingways and all that sort of thing. So the world sort of collided. I think it's very interesting about power. There's a bit in it that says about how people would come together in some sort of mix of breeding, money and talent. And that's how people were corralled together. So Winston Churchill, he was a guest of hers and a friend and was often at their house, and he liked to talk politics with people, but he also liked to be entertained by pretty women.
Interesting. So there's kind of a mix between the sort of high society of the UK, which is obviously Winston Churchill is a very kind of upper class man, and then some people who are just talented actresses and that kind of thing as well. So they're all kind of mixing on the French Riviera.
Yeah, and it's all sort of very well written and full of little, you know, on every page there's some sort of delight, some lovely little detail, like the bit about when Winston Churchill earlier on in his life is courting women, and one of them turns him down because she thinks he'll never amount to anything.
Really?
But again, you know, tennis matches. Clementine Churchill really likes tennis, but she doesn't like the more vulgar elements of the house party. So by the time they're in the south of France, she doesn't go to the parties. Beach pajamas as well. They were sort of newly invented, so women would come to these cocktail parties wearing silk beach pajamas and drink cocktails, and often get into trouble, you know, so car crashes would happen as a result of drinking too much at the party.
Fascinating. The Riviera Set by Mary Lovell is out now, published by Little Brown. And I'm afraid that brings us to the end of today's show. Thanks very much to my guest, Kathy Rensenbrink. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. My producer was Holly Fisher, and the show was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time tomorrow for our weekly film review, this time with Jason Solomons. But for now, thanks very much for listening, and goodbye.